Cute. So before I get too far, I do want to bring your attention to the last line. As a DOJ employee, I need to say that anything I'm saying today is not necessarily reflective of Department of Justice or BJS views. So just keep this in mind. This is actually was my doctoral dissertation. Okay, I have nothing to disclose. Okay. So in today's world, we know how to prevent people from dying in pregnancy. Pregnancy is not a new condition. Childbirth is not a new condition. This is not a disease we just discovered or something we're still trying to figure out. People have been having babies for a long time. Yet we see that their mothers are continuing to die at alarmingly high rates. And in particular, that many of these deaths are preventable. So that's really what I want you to keep your mind on, is that these are, you know, the focus of these preventable maternal deaths. The second kind of key aspect is that I'm uniting violence against women as well, and that is also almost fully 100% preventable as well. So maternal mortality and violence against women, they represent significant gender-based health disparities, and this is largely because only women can die from a pregnancy-associated death or a maternal death, and only females can become pregnant from a violent act. So first and foremost, I do see this as an issue of gender inequality. But as we go through the presentation, I hope to highlight how other sources of inequality, in particular race and economic disparities, are also at play. Okay, so some technical stuff. What my research is focusing on is the latter term, pregnancy-associated death. And that's a wider definition and one that's a little looser than that of maternal mortality. So maternal mortality, that's the death of a woman while pregnant or within 42 days of termination of pregnancy. And so that definition and those surveillance systems are not going to capture deaths due to homicide, suicide, accidental overdoses, and I believe motor vehicle accidents as well. And so again, I'm looking at pregnancy-associated death, which is the death of a woman while pregnant or within 1 year of termination of pregnancy, irrespective of cause. There's also pregnancy-related deaths, but I'm not going to get into that and further complicate things. Okay, so what is the scope of the problem? So the United States has been said to be in the midst of a maternal mortality epidemic, and indeed our cases of maternal death, which I tend to use kind of generically, by the way, women are dying at higher rates than they should. We are not an irreducible minimum. So currently, depending again on the surveillance method, we rank about 41st in the world, although I've also seen it a little lower, around 32. But regardless, we've got one of the highest rates among developed nations, if not the highest rate of developed nations. And this is not new. This pattern has been observed for about 15 years. So our maternal mortality rate in the United States, it really plummeted through the beginning of the 20th century, obviously due to our advancement, sanitation, we know to wash our hands. And so that reduced our maternal mortality death rates by about 99%. But in the mid-80s, our rate stagnated to about six per 100,000 live births, six deaths. And since then, they've been increasing and have actually doubled. I will say that our improvement, our surveillance systems have improved, so some of that increase is just that we're now capturing more deaths. However, again, most of these deaths that are occurring in the United States, there is a degree of preventability. And so we're still talking about women that are dying well before their life expectancy. And so that's a key issue. So our national rate in 2010 was about 12.7 deaths, but this rate masks the racial disparities that are present. Black women have a rate of about 3.2 to 4 times more likely to die from a pregnancy-associated or maternal death than white women. And there's also within state variations as well, but I'm not going to cover that. So because this was part of my sociology dissertation, we love our theory, and I toyed back and forth with including it, but I went ahead and decided to because I think it's really a key aspect of public health and one that we don't talk about quite as much. Preventable maternal mortality has been recognized as a human rights violation by a number of international bodies, agencies, expert researchers. And as I said, I'm starting this from a source of gender inequality. So almost every female around the world has or currently is experiencing varying degrees of these four gender-based human rights violations. The first, an inability to express her sexuality without consequences. We see this today with what they call slut-shaming, a time-honored condition, a time-honored tradition, unfortunately. The inability to control her reproduction, women's abortion rights are still being constantly rolled back, and we're still fighting for those. The devaluation of social reproduction, child care, and domestic work, and the threat of male violence. So bridging this now into other forms of human rights violations. So the contemporary human rights movement is generally associated with the founding of the United Nations following the Holocaust and World War II. And I use the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as kind of my framing document, because this is one of the few that the United States has actually signed and ratified. So a few of the different articles, freedom from discrimination, the right to life, liberty, and security of person, the right to marriage and found a family, the family is entitled to protection by society and the state, and we tend to still keep a what happens in the home stays in the home kind of approach in the United States. The right to work, protection against unemployment, the right to equal pay for equal work, standard of living, and then the last one, motherhood and childhood, are entitled to special care and assistance. So what I like about human rights is it provides the means to understand different forms of inequality at work and how those different levels and forms can create real challenges for real people and real health outcomes as a result. I also like it because it provides us a vision of a just world and one that we can actually use to picture free of injustice, free of indignity. And it gives us the tools to work towards a better future. This is my conceptual model of human rights and maternal health, and I designed it specific to maternal health in the United States. So in human rights, there's often a distinction between first-generation rights, which are your civil and political rights, which is what most of us think about when we think about human rights. But then the second generations of rights are your social, economic, cultural rights. So by law, citizens of the United States, we're entitled to many civil and political rights, like the right to vote, the right to be free from discrimination based on one's gender and race. We are not, however, entitled to many of our second-generation rights, such as the right to health care, the right to a living wage. While compared to some countries around the world, women in the U.S. certainly have a considerable degree of freedom, civil and political rights are not the same as human rights, and, for example, the right to vote does not a whole person make. So, for example, to kind of illustrate the interdependence of some of these sectors, what's the use of the right to vote if your husband beats you and you can't get to the polls to vote? What use was the right to vote to a black woman in 1950? So we have to go a little further in how we think about our rights in the United States. So one of the main differences between kind of the civil and political and social and economic is the entitlements, which is a dirty little word. So our economic, social, and cultural rights are positive rights or entitlements to a certain standard that should be provided by the state or a national government, whereas your freedom, your civil and political rights, those are things that nobody has to give you. They just have to protect you from it. So it's the difference in freedoms from discrimination, versus rights to, the rights to health and safety. So now to actually get to my study. So my methodology, this was a case study analysis of pregnancy-associated deaths, and the Commonwealth of Virginia was gracious enough to let me access their data, which was one of the few states that was willing to do so among the states that have this type of review board. And the maternal mortality review team is housed in the Department of Health with the Office of the Chief Medical Examiner. I acquired an aggregated data set that had been de-identified and contained all the deaths at that time from 1999 to 2005. And there's a significant time lag here that's just due to the nature of maternal review. So this was actually the latest years they available at that time. So my sample has 309 pregnancy-associated deaths, and I did secondary data analysis with SPSS. But that being said, most of my analysis was really just frequencies and crosstabs. I did not do significance testing. I did not do modeling. And I made that choice because most of these were categorical variables, and I was not going to rank homicide versus cardiac disorder versus suicide. So that is an analytic decision I made. What I did do was I calculated the pregnancy-associated mortality rate, and that denominator data was provided to me by the Department of Health. And one of the last things is that counts of six or fewer cannot be displayed. And as a result, I often can't display totals in the table. And this is due to the really strict privacy laws that garner fatality and death reviews. So I combined natural pregnancy-associated deaths into one category to kind of get my count up, and I had 12 causes of death: AIDS-related amniotic fluid embolism, cancer, cardiac disorder, cardiomyopathy, disorders of the central nervous system, exacerbation of chronic diseases, ectopic pregnancies, hemorrhage, infection, pregnancy-induced hypertension, preeclampsia or eclampsia, and then the last was pulmonary embolism. So these 12 conditions became kind of my natural manner of death group. And then I also pulled out my homicides, my suicides, and my accidental overdoses. And those are referred to as violent deaths by the Virginia mortality team. So I took all their values at face value. These are my three research questions. It's violent causes of death, a leading cause of pregnancy-associated death. My second asked about socio-demographic differences. And then my third was domestic violence a factor in violent causes of death. Again, I'm using domestic violence. I know some people prefer interpersonal violence or this kind or that, but domestic violence is the term Virginia used, so that's what I'm using as well. So this is the findings of my first research question: was homicide a leading cause of death? Homicide is all the way over there on the left, the nice big tall bar. And there were 46 cases of homicide in the sample, which was about 15% of all the deaths in the sample. You can see that it's tied with motor vehicle accidents, which also had 46 deaths. Accidental overdose is fifth, and that was 21 cases, about 6.8% of the sample. And then suicide was the sixth with 20 cases, about 6.5% of the sample. So altogether, these three forms of violence comprise 87 cases, and it's about 28% of the sample. The 12 natural causes of death was 53%, 165 cases. But again, that's 12 causes of death aggregated into one. Not displayed here are ectopic, AIDS-related, and undetermined, because those were less than six deaths. So this is some of our demographic pregnancy data, as I'm calling it, mode of termination of index pregnancy. Vaginal delivery was the most common across all of our different categories: homicide, suicide, accidental overdose, and natural. But what I'd like to look at more is these down here in the interval. So after this 42 days, that six-week period, that's sort of the cutoff between maternal mortality and pregnancy-associated and pregnancy-related deaths. And what you can see is that homicide, there's actually almost a near even split between women who died the same day the baby was terminated or who died within 181 to 365 days. And you can see all the accidental overdoses and suicides all occurred, at least where we have the data, after that six-week period. And natural, it was a more or less even distribution. Okay, so I was able to look at whether the pregnancy was intended and whether or not it was wanted. One of the things with maternal mortality review is there's a lot of missing data. Not all the cases have every variable of interest, and so some of these denominators are actually quite small. So I want to emphasize that this is one of those cases, and this is all based on just what we know. So that doesn't mean that this is the definitive cases. Homicide and suicide, with the data we know, about an even split between those who intended to get pregnant and those who didn't. Suicide, almost all the women did intend to get pregnant. You can kind of see the other ones. About 8 of the 46 cases of homicide were known to the baby was not wanted by the mother or the father, and this is about 17%. But this is compared to 0% of suicides, which I found to be very interesting. I actually expected that to be higher. So I was surprised by that. And you can see accidental overdose and natural, about 29% of accidental overdoses was not wanted, and about 10% of natural. These are the counts. Okay, father of baby and decedent's relationship. Almost all the homicide victims were unmarried, and they tended to be younger. So most of the fathers of the baby were a boyfriend, whereas natural tended to be the husband was more often the father of the baby, and same for suicide and accidental overdose as well. And down here, you can see that, yes, these people were known to have been estranged from the father at the time of death. So 41% of homicide victims, they were known to be estranged. We knew that. Again, we see high rates among those who committed suicide, about 60%. This is some of the other maternal demographics. Race is on the next slide, so we're going to have a whole other slide on that. But age, the sample didn't skew disproportionately young or disproportionately old. Most people fell within kind of what we think of as our healthy pregnancy range. Unfortunately, this variable already came aggregated, so I wasn't able to do kind of like a median or a mean age. Our marital status, married, not married, I'm not going to highlight that too much. Education, there were some differences. Homicide victims tended to be a little less educated, but again, I think that had to do more with their age versus other factors. So this, I looked at black and white only, again, because of our, because of my privacy kind of constriction. I just didn't have enough cases to be able to discuss Asian Americans in the sample or Hispanics in the sample as well. What I want to highlight is that homicide is the leading manner of death for black women. So more women die from homicide in this sample than any other cause, period. A quarter of all black women who died were murdered, and black women accounted for 60% of these homicides. However, there's significant racial disparities in accidental overdose and suicide as well, where you can see that those were almost all white women, about 90%, more or less. So the black-white ratio, 4.5, black women were more likely to be murdered or at a rate, 4.5. Natural, I changed this last night, I knew that was a typo. But that should be 3.4. And so our total is black women, again, had a higher rate of about 4.5 than white women, and their natural rate, again, this should be 3.4, but that was also higher. And this graph just kind of shows that in a pretty manner. So a quick summary of our homicide deaths. 58% of the victims were black women, 41% were white women. 85% of the women knew their attackers. So this was not a case of stranger danger. These women knew their attackers. In 90% of the cases with data, the perpetrator was male. And guns were the fatal agency in 60% of homicides, as well as actually a quarter of suicides. Was domestic violence known to be a factor? Where we had data available, we know that this occurred in 30 cases. 24 of those 30 experienced it as victims only, because some of these were both victim and perpetrator only. Homicide victims had very high rates of experiencing domestic violence relative to the other courses, and women who died from natural deaths had some of the lowest rates of known domestic violence. I also looked at estimated prevalence in a past relationship, and this was about 8%. And these are in line with other studies that have assessed this at about 8% as well, but there's quite a range. I looked at a few incidences of life stressors. The maternal mortality review team collected this information for violent deaths only. And so what I found is that of the women who died of violence, they had very high rates of experiencing at least one stressor. And this is important because it kind of relates back to my human rights thing. You know, so we see that this is more than just a gender issue. There are other stressors, other pressures, other factors, other things that are affecting these women and their lives. Women who died from an accidental overdose had very high rates of substance use and abuse in the past year, high rates of unemployment, and there was also women in this sample who had very sad stories, including prostitution, homelessness, incarceration, and so forth. All right, so homicide was the leading matter of death. If you take away nothing else from, from this presentation, please take that away. Violence comprised almost a third of all the deaths in the sample. There's evidence that many of our homicides were likely cases of domestic violence or that was a factor in it. Black women died at higher rates than white women. And the estimated prevalence of domestic violence was about 10%, about 8 to 10%, depending on the exact indicator that I use. So again, gender-based violence was a known factor in many homicides. Racial differences and mortality rates were present. There's evidence that many women did not enjoy reproductive justice, which is the right to have a child, the right not to have a child, and the right to parent your child in a safe manner. And we know that many of these women wanted their babies. They wanted those babies, and they didn't get to pay a parent to them. In addition, there's 563 infants and children in this sample alone who no longer have a mother. I've got a whole slew of recommendations. I'm not going to go into all of them because I'm very short on time. But the main thing, again, I really just want to drive home that this is preventable. Our maternal mortality systems need to be improved, particular surveillance systems. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done there for sure. And just this issue of violence as a whole in our society and community is just, we've got to know more about it, and the public health model does provide a means to do that through prevention, intervention, and response. But I did throw in some other things, you know, increasing funding, reforming state gun laws, because this is really a wraparound thing. It's not a magic bullet, and even just stopping violence against women may not be enough. Limitations, results not generalizable, small sample, limited data. I didn't have all the variables I wanted, such as income. Strengths, this does support some hypotheses that violence is a key factor, international research on violence and maternal mortality as well. Virginia population allowed for me to look at black and white populations, which was important because you can't oversample. and this also demonstrated the utility and importance of state-level maternal death surveillance. Okay. So in conclusion, these findings bolster support for the urgent need to identify and recognize violence as a social determinant of health. And it also locates the perpetrator in the system of human rights violations as well, because they likely experienced violence and trauma growing up, and it also experienced stress, strain as well. Okay. These are my acknowledgments, the wonderful people that helped me through this project, and I thank you all very much for your time.